We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It is, how many days we got till November 3rd? We're down to like 13 days thereabouts.
10 days as of today. Yeah.
It's okay. Well.
Yeah. And the good news is people are voting in amazing numbers in Washington State. We have, what is it? Some, as of yesterday, Oh yeah, we had something like 46.6% of registered Seattle voters have already voted, as of Friday. So that's a remarkable total. The normal would, for this time in an election, would be about 15 to 20%. So
I think it's also a comment on our choices this time around too, because when races are close or people are unsure about which candidate to vote for, or they feel like they have too many choices, maybe they wait until the last minute to vote.
Well, or if they're secure about mailing in their ballots,
I think that's
a huge factor too. A lot of people are using drop boxes this year.
I mailed my ballot. And I've been noticing that the local post office has been doing pretty good with local mail.
Oh, that's good. Well, I would encourage people to not take chances if you're not sure about it. You know, there's plenty of drop boxes, and you got 10 days. So if you just can't make up your mind about president, well, we'll try to help you with that.
Yeah, although if you are like me and you don't mind taking a chance, make sure you tear off the strip at the top of your ballot so that you can track your ballot and see when it's received and when it's counted.
That's a really handy feature.
And if you're going to mail it soon. Don't wait until the last couple days.
Yep, absolutely.
All right.
So, 10 days, November 3rd. It's going to be an interesting ride.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and the ride continues after the third for those of you wanting to get your money's worth.
Yeah.
All right.
The carnival will not leave town right away.
It might not leave town at all.
Maria, do you want to talk about the LGBTQ commission?
I can, indeed. A couple of weeks ago, as folks may remember, the Seattle Human Rights Commission released a letter calling for Mayor Durkin to resign, and if she wouldn't do it, for the city council to remove her from office. Now the Seattle LGBTQ Commission has done the same, issuing a letter this week that says they've been trying for months to work with Durkin's office on police violence during this summer's protests and the Seattle Police Department's use of tear gas and pepper spray in the Capitol Hill neighborhood, which has a primarily LGBTQ demographic. But Durkin's office has not responded until just the past few days when the commission put a vote on their agenda calling for her resignation. Then Durkin herself didn't respond, which I found kind of interesting. Instead, she sent Deputy Mayor Shefali Ranganathan to attend the meeting and to speak with the commission. Nevertheless, even though Deputy Mayor Ranganathan spoke to them and argued on Mayor Durkin's behalf, the LGBTQ commission voted in a 6-5-1 vote to call for Mayor Durkin's resignation. Those who voted against it said that they voted no primarily because the commission was finally seeing some response from the mayor's office and they were hopeful that Durkin might still respond to their concerns. The majority, however, felt that just wasn't going to happen. In their letter, they say, quote, crisis management cannot be viewed as a substitution for authentic engagement, end quote. In other words, this last-ditch effort by Deputy Mayor Ranganathan to forestall their vote was not real engagement from the mayor's office. Now, remember that Durkin herself identifies as lesbian. So to see the LGBTQ commission call for her resignation has got to be a major blow for her and for them.
And she was saying quite a bit during the summer, you know, Capitol Hill and Cal Anderson Park are really important to me as a lesbian. She was playing that card. So for her not to respond to that community says a lot about how authentic that concern was.
Yeah. So there are three quotes that I want to read from the letter. The letter's long. It's about 5 pages long, but it's definitely worth looking up and reading if you have the chance. The reasons that they give are very similar to the reasons given by the Human Rights Commission, and it's worth reading. On Mayor Durkan's refusal to take responsibility for the police violence this summer, because of course she has said, you know, oh, I don't have control over the police; it's the chief of police who does. And in particular, they hit her on the gassing of the entire Capitol Hill area, which is heavily LGBTQ. They say, and this is a direct quote from the letter, under the Seattle Municipal Code, the mayor's office has broad authority to reprimand or remove the police chief if they have been in dereliction of their authority, Article 6, Section 2. As defined by the Charter of the City of Seattle, the mayor also can take full or partial control of the police force in the case of an emergency, provided the mayor issues a proclamation to that effect, Article 5, Section 2. In such circumstances, it is the duty of the chief of police to execute the orders of the mayor. Despite the mayor's continued assertions that the chief of police is responsible for oversight of SPD, it is clear that the office of mayor has the right and obligation to intervene when necessary. Mayor Durkan exercised her executive authority multiple times in June 2020 by repeatedly instituting citywide curfews by executive order, which would have constituted an emergency, end quote. So they're basically saying, look, you can't weasel out of your responsibility to oversee the police department and its broken use of force and crowd control policies. And remember, those policies have been heavily criticized by all three oversight bodies for the Seattle Police Department, the OPA, the OIG, that's the Office of Inspector General for the SPD, and the Community Police Commission have all issued reports saying that the Seattle Police Department's policies on crowd control are broken and need fixing. Now, the letter goes on. It says on Durkan's unwillingness to reimagine policing, and those are Durkan's own words, that she's wants to reimagine policing. The letter really takes her to task on that, especially the way that she's been muddling the budget process. So another quote, this one a little bit longer. Despite overwhelming calls from the community and Black leaders to cut the SPD budget by at least 50% in both 2020 and for future years, Mayor Durkan has repeatedly objected to meaningful reductions in SPD's budget, and they italicize the word meaningful. The mayor's initial budget adjustment for 2020 cut SPD's budget by only $20 million, less than 5% of the $409 million SPD had been allocated for the year. These cuts were made because of budget rebalancing due to the COVID-19 pandemic, not in response to Black Lives Matter protests. It is worth noting that many city departments were asked to cut their budgets by greater percentages, including the Office for Civil Rights, who administers the city's race and social justice initiative, which was asked to cut 7% of its $7 million annual budget. When Seattle City Council added an additional $3 million to the SPD cuts in their revised 2020 budget, Mayor Durkan vetoed the revised budget. Furthermore, Mayor Durkan's current proposed budget for 2021, which includes funding for 1,400 positions for the police department, effectively increases, and they italicize the word increases, the size of the police force, given that due to attrition of police officers, SPD currently has 1,367 officers and recruits. At the same time, the mayor's 2021 budget cuts $30 million dedicated to combating displacement and advancing equity through the Equity Fund. All in all, the mayor's office has fought to maintain SPD funding while cutting or reallocating funds devoted to racial equity efforts. So essentially they're saying, you know, that's the end of the quote. Essentially they're saying that, you know, you're being hypocritical, Mayor Durkan.
Yeah, they're calling her on her BS, basically.
Yeah. You keep saying you're reimagining policing, but what you're doing is you're just increasing resources for the police department, still trying to beef it up, and you're completely ignoring calls for the Black community to fund real social equity and social justice initiatives. And then the final quote is, they call Durkan out on her failure to deal with the housing and homelessness crisis. Quote, in Deputy Mayor Sheffaly Ranganathan's letter to our commission, she responded to the Human Rights Commission's criticisms about Mayor Durkan's opposition to a Seattle payroll tax by noting that the mayor supports a regional payroll tax instituted by the state. Mayor Durkan's opposition to and veto of the Jumpstart spending plan undermines that commitment, particularly given that Mayor Durkan's role is to serve as the executive for Seattle and not as a lobbyist in Olympia. Ultimately, Mayor Durkan's opposition to the Jumpstart legislation disempowered the process taken to get there, which included months of work from Black communities, Indigenous communities, other communities of color, labor, and many more to find ways to fund affordable housing, end quote. So again, they're hitting her on her inability to work with others, particularly the city council and for groups within the community. And I should mention one group that they don't add to that list is progressive business leaders who were also at the table to try to help craft a tax that they thought that the business community would be okay with paying. And Durkan decided, nope, she was going to veto that. So,
yeah,
you know, they're really, really calling her out on her inability to lead and to compromise.
And her ability to negotiate with leaders from the Black community has been terrible also. She's alienated most of those groups as well.
Yeah. And the letter goes on to mention other issues, including equitable budgeting, which the mayor opposes, and her appropriation of Jumpstart tax money to fund her own personal task force and to award money to community groups that she supports, not groups that the community necessarily supports heavily. It's a really scathing letter, and it's really worth a read. And again, the LGBTQ commission, like the Human Rights Commission, is made up of members appointed by both the city council and the mayor. And the commission itself appoints a few more members, just like the Human Rights Commission. That leaves just one more advisory commission funded by the city, the Seattle Women's Commission, to weigh in if they feel the need. Last week, Deputy Mayor Ranganathan also met with the Women's Commission to do damage control on behalf of Mayor Durkan. And we don't know yet how the Women's Commission will respond to that meeting. They did, back in June, though, issue a statement in support of the protests this summer, calling for the mayor and city council to, and this is a quote from their letter that the Women's Commission issued in June, to, quote, expand investments in services that will make our communities safe, affordable, accessible housing, affordable and quality childcare, domestic violence and sexual assault survivor support, and mental health care, among others, end quote. And they called for, quote, disciplinary action for the officer who sprayed a young person in the face with pepper spray, end quote, which, of course, hasn't happened because the OPA ruled that that was, quote unquote, an accident, a mistake, you know.
Oops.
But it
was a mistake the first time. What about the second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth time?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to this whole issue of why is the SPD using pepper spray heavily on peaceful protesters, you know, and that goes right back to Mayor Durkan.
Yeah. So I don't think that Durkan is going to resign anytime soon. However, I have it on authority of, let's just say, as source close to the mayor's office, that she will not be running for re-election next year. And the reason is not any of the community opposition to her, necessarily. It's that nobody will write her a check, and that's a direct quote. In other words, she has lost the support of the business community as well. So she really doesn't have any kind of a base left. And obviously, this isn't official yet. Nobody's going to make any official announcements until after November 3rd. But this is setting in motion a whole chain of dominoes, along with the fact that Jay Inslee is reportedly under heavy consideration for a post in Joe Biden's cabinet should he win. That would open up the governor's office, and that would open up Seattle mayor's office in 2021. Dow Constantine is reportedly considering very heavily whether to run for Seattle mayor if the governor's office doesn't open up. He very badly wants to be governor, but if for some reason that doesn't appear viable, he is looking at Seattle mayor as well. Lorena Gonzalez is looking at both of those as well. So there's a whole chain of dominoes.
That Bob Ferguson's also looking at the governor's seat as well.
Yes, Bob Ferguson and Hillary Frans were expected to run before Jay Inslee announced that he was seeking a third term. So there's at least four competitors for governor that we know of on the Democratic side. God knows who will run among the Republicans. Judging from Lauren Culp, their bench is very, very thin. But it's going to be a very interesting season locally, because you might have an open mayor's seat. You might have, if Lorena Gonzalez decides to run, she is up for reelection in 2021 for her at-large city council seat. So she would have to abandon that seat in order to run for another office. So that would potentially open up another seat on city council as well. So there's this whole chain of dominoes. And there's also the question, if Constantine runs for another office, he would be up for reelection. So somebody that would be an open seat as well. Somebody from county council perhaps would run for county executive. There'd be a whole chain of dominoes in effect, and, you know, shuffling deck chairs and all the rest of that. It's going to be very interesting to see in November and December, once people can start raising money for the 2021 cycle, who's going to announce for what. But if you think we need a more progressive mayor, now would be the time to start lining that up for a campaign, because there will be an opportunity. Mayor Durkin will not be around to kick around anymore. And I have to think that's good news for a whole lot of people.
Well, I think, too, if Mayor Durkin's not going to be around, and if Lorena Gonzalez does try to jump to running for the mayor's office, then, you know, there'll be a question of an open seat for the city council. Both she and Teresa Mosqueda will be up for reelection.
Exactly.
And, Mosqueda will probably be a shoe-in, but, you know, with an open at large seat on the city council, I'm sure there are some progressives who have run for office in the past who would be interested in that.
Yeah, very much so. I can think of a couple names offhand, but
I can too. But so, I don't want to mention them because they might want to run for mayor. So
yeah, sure. Or they may not want to run at all. They might be kind of sick of the whole thing.
They might want to run for the border.
depending on who becomes president. Right.
Yeah, they might want to run for their lives, yeah. So, it's going to be an interesting 2021. But, of course, first we have to get through this election, and that's going to be a challenge, too.
Yeah.
Also, this week, City Council was working on replacements for the navigation team.
Yeah, you know, when the City Council passed the revised 2020 budget back in August, they cut money for the navigation team. Mayor Durkin's and before her Mayor Ed Murray's solution to the homelessness crisis here in Seattle, that team of mostly Seattle police officers who swept tent encampments, right? Now, the mayor vetoed that budget, but the council overrode the veto. Then Mayor Durkin announced, kind of in a fit of pique, that the city would completely stop dealing with tent encampments altogether. And that's even though the city council had approved nearly $3 million in funding for the city to do outreach to unsheltered homeless people in the 2020 budget that doesn't involve using the police department. Durkin, however, has refused to spend that money unless she can spend it on encampment sweeps. Now, this week, three members of the city council, Andrew Lewis, Tammy Morales, and Lisa Herbold, have worked with Deputy Mayor Casey Sixkiller, Human Services Department head Jason Johnson, and representatives of local nonprofit groups to craft a replacement for the navigation team. In essence, they're doing what Mayor Durkin has refused to do. Andrew Lewis this week issued a press release announcing a bill to create and fund the new Unsheltered Outreach and Response Team. It will consist of 8 civilian employees within the city's Human Services Department who will coordinate the flow of money and city resources to local nonprofit service providers who will do the outreach instead of Seattle Police Department officers and city employees.
So in essence, Durkin has already quit her job.
Yeah. In this respect. Lewis emphasized that this is just the first step and that the city and the city council will have to do more, including fund and implement a civilian 911 response team for nonviolent emergencies. Also, this agreement is just for this year. It just takes the place of the work Mayor Durkin should be doing this year. And it's really a bill to get the mayor to spend at least some of that $2.9 million that the city council allocated for outreach. Now,
it does give a framework for 2021.
It does. But that's going to be part of the city council's current, budget negotiations that they're working on right now for 2021. Now, some of the folks who were at the table to negotiate this deal include Colleen Echohawk of the Chief Seattle Club, Chloe Gale of REACH, and Lisa Dogard of the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program, which goes by the acronym LEAD. And it has been a model for nationwide efforts to divert low-level offenders from the criminal justice system and into treatment and human services that gets them off the street and into stable housing and jobs.
And that's another program that Durkin tried to cut last year.
Yeah, and REACH, yeah, in spite of the fact that the city council had budgeted money to expand the LEAD program. And REACH, too, was the main nonprofit that used to work with the city in providing outreach to homeless encampments before Durkin hijacked the navigation team and turned it into a special unit of the Seattle Police Department. REACH quit after that happened, saying that they could no longer just stand by and watch Seattle police sweeping homeless people without the city providing and without their ability to provide any meaningful services or outreach to homeless people. And they in particular faulted the navigation team sweep policy because it meant that it made it so much harder for REACH to track people when they were just being shuffled around from place to place. They couldn't keep track of people and they couldn't provide them meaningful services. Now, while Deputy Mayor Sixkiller has worked really hard to reach this agreement with the city council and these nonprofit groups, it's clear that Mayor Durkin is much less enthusiastic about it. Her spokesperson couldn't resist scolding the city council this week, saying, quote, as council knows, outreach and mitigation at those encampments that present significant public safety or health risks may continue to need the support and services of the Seattle Police Department, end quote. So she just had to get a little
really know that at all.
Yeah, just had to get a little
I think it's pretty counterproductive, honestly.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Essentially, she was in that announcement. Her spokesperson was saying that, yeah, okay, Mayor Durkin will spend the money once the council passes the bill. But, you know, there's still a role for the police department. So that was her response.
All right. Mm-hmm. Tangential to that, the OPA this week released some more rulings on complaints.
Yeah.
They got a whole bunch of deadlines coming up, don't they?
Yeah, you would think. They took something like 15,000 to 16,000 complaints. They've taken 15,000 to 16,000 complaints from people who have been injured at protests this summer, and because of the Seattle Police Department's broken crowd control policies and their use of pepper spray, rubber bullets, flashbang grenades, tear gas. And the OPA took those complaints and they've consolidated a whole bunch of them down. But they have 90 days in which they have to rule on a complaint, whether or not it is sustained or whether it should be dismissed. This is the second group of complaints that the OPA has issued a ruling for. This time there were five from May 29th and from the first week of June. Only two of the five were sustained. In the two that were sustained, one was a young woman whose head was slammed into the ground twice by a cop who was arresting her. The OPA ruled that it was okay for the officer to shove her face down onto the ground to arrest her, but that it was not, quote, not proportional, end quote, for him to slam her head down. And I guess that was pretty clear. In the second case, the protester was forcibly caught and arrested by two SPD officers. When the protester hit the first officer with his water bottle, the officer punched him twice in the face, which the OPA ruled a reasonable use of force. But then after a few seconds delay, a second officer jumped in and punched the protester seven or eight times, which the OPA ruled an excessive use of force. But an additional beating occurred when the protester grabbed the second officer's hand to stop that excessive use of force. The OPA ruled that by trying to stop the excessive use of force, this act meant that both police were then allowed to continue to beat the protester, and that the following knee strike and crossface, essentially a forearm file across his face, were appropriate uses of force. And that's really what's wrong with this minute examination of slow motion video, right? I mean, it separates these acts from any context. And when there's no discussion of context, of intent, of why the person was arrested, of why they might have resisted at certain stages of the arrest, of how and why the encounter escalated, then you don't get real justice. For example, you can look at the fifth case, in which a woman who claimed that an officer shoved her backwards onto the ground was not sustained. The OPA ruled that the woman actually tripped over another person's foot. And when you look at the video, yes, that is what happened. However, she only tripped over that person's foot because a police officer grabbed her from behind and hauled her backwards over that person's foot and then drug her straight to the ground. So it's really clear in that video that that was not a proportional use of force, right? If the officer had not grabbed her by the backpack and hauled her backwards, she would not have tripped and fallen flat on the ground. Yet the OPA ruled in the officer's favor because they didn't really look at intent and they didn't look at context. And that's a major problem with either with the OPA or with their process. And I think also, just in general, a major problem with the fact that we have a mayor who will do nothing to try to rein in our out of control police force.
Yeah, and it makes me wonder if Durkin winds up being a lame duck mayor, if she's going to just let Adrian Diaz be an interim police chief and let the next mayor pick a new police chief. So we could have pretty leaderless SPD and an out-of-control department for the next year.
Yeah. I want to emphasize, too, Adrian Diaz has very little patrol experience and certainly not any experience when it comes to demonstrations and crowd control like this. Similar to Carmen Best, he's running a department in which he sort of plays a nice PR role, somebody who's good at talking to the press, who's good at making announcements, and great at press conferences, but not so good at understanding the dynamics of on-street patrol work, and not great at understanding crowd control dynamics.
And he doesn't have much respect from the rank and file officers because he's not really one of them.
Yeah, he's not really, he's not a patrol officer.
Hey, you continue on that?
No, I'm done.
Okay, I was going to say, I saw this week that it was reported that Carmen Best has found new employment both as a working with a private security firm and as a consultant to multiple NBC outlets, including the local King 5 affiliate.
Oh, yeah.
I'm surprised.
That was her role in the Seattle Police Department. She came up through the ranks by serving on various units that were doing PR work for the Seattle Police Department. So I'm not surprised. I would assume that would be a natural fit for her.
Yeah.
And following with a tradition similar to the military, where generals apparently become spokespeople on the major corporate media outlets.
Yeah, well, they're the experts on war, after all. You can't have a peace activist in that role because they might say something wrong.
Well, examining context, again, is not something that you want to do, right?
No. Apparently not.
At least on the public airwaves.
Yeah. Except on KODX.
Yeah.
We're all about context.
And multiple other fine local outlets, small local outlets.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank God for independent media.
Yes. And even more importantly than God, thank goodness for our listeners and supporters.
Yes.
Yes, and it's a good time to say to people that if you love listening to this program every week. If you support KODX, it's great to show us a little love financially as well. You can go to our website, kodxseattle.org, and make a contribution to the station. We would much appreciate that. We are all volunteer, and we heavily rely on our listeners' support.
Yep.
And should also let people know that we are quickly approaching the end of the year when we lose our space where we are currently based out of for doing our over-the-air transmissions. The plan is we'll still be streaming until we can find financial support to get another tower and another antenna.
We are another victim of gentrification.
Yes. Yeah. So, just a heads up on that.
Yep.
All right. Back to the good news.
Hey,
I did my good news for the week, right?
Oh, so. you have more. Don't worry. In fact, aren't there some fresh numbers for the pandemic for the region for this week?
Yeah, there are, and that wasn't the good news I was thinking of. the Washington State Department of Health is now saying that, the state of Washington has been trending upward for the last month or so, and the center of that pandemic is King, Pierce, and Snohomish counties in Puget Sound. So we are definitely not out of the woods yet, and there are, our daily state numbers are starting to approach last spring's highs. Jade Inslee this week announced an extension of the rent moratorium on evictions, rental evictions, and commercial lease evictions until the end of the year. I expect it'll be extended beyond that as well, but it'll depend on whether he remains governor or not, I suppose, or that pandemic management will be handed over to the next governor like a lovely welcoming gift. And speaking of which, nationally, Donald Trump is leaving the country a tremendous party gift. Yesterday was a new record for daily cases in the United States. The final tally was over 85,000. That shatters the previous record that was set in July. And the problem with this is it's happening all over. The past history of the pandemic has been one of waves where, for instance, first it was landed on the West Coast, and then the Northeast got it badly, and then this summer the Sun Belt. Right now it's all over, and it's community spread. It's happening in a lot of rural areas, and that means it's going to be much more difficult to contain the pandemic. And, of course, the Trump administration nationally is making absolutely no effort to do so, and instead is pretending it's all over, which is magical thinking doesn't really work with a pandemic. We're starting to see some Republican states reluctantly take statewide actions. Others are saying no, just let it rip, because that's not the role of government to respond to a public health emergency. We're seeing also huge numbers in Europe. They're sustaining a serious second or third wave, particularly Western Europe, but actually every country in the European Union is seeing rising numbers, and in some cases record rising numbers. And for context, the worst per capita pandemic in the world right now is in Belgium, with about 820 per million cases. North Dakota in the United States is in the 900s right now. So we've got some really bad situations in a lot of areas, particularly the upper Midwest, the Rocky Mountain West. But it really is all over. Literally starting to spike again in New England, which seemed to have it under control much of the summer. Rhode Island is seeing high per capita rates. In New York City is starting to, and Boston have looked at closing their in-person schools because that didn't really work out. And we're starting to get cold weather, as people may have noticed this morning, and that means more people staying indoors and more chances for the virus to spread. So now is not the time to relax on your precautions. Social distancing, mask wearing, all of it. We really have to buckle down on this for the next couple months at least, I think.
All right.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be longer than a couple months. I think one of the big reasons we're seeing more spread, particularly in a place like Washington, where we've had where we locked down pretty early and we've had phased reopenings, is that people are showing a lot of COVID fatigue, you know?
Very much so. And that's true all over the country.
They want to go back to normal. They want to go back to the way things were before. And I think we just need to, in our minds, get to a place where we know that it's going to be a while longer and things can't completely go back to the way they were before and may not for a while yet. So we just need to continue to be vigilant.
And a reality check on vaccines. First of all, a large part of the country is saying they don't want to take a vaccine. That will change somewhat if Trump is no longer in office, because people don't trust his FDA to, regulate fairly. And, you know, you can't trust anything coming out of Trump's mouth. We'll talk about the debate in a minute. But one of the things he rattled off in the debate was all of these companies that he said were on the verge of being able to produce a vaccine and they'll have it by the end of the year. Well, one of the companies he named hasn't even begun phase three trials yet, which means they're at least, 6 months to a year out. 6 months is an extremely expedited process. I honestly, and, phase three is where most vaccines fail. Because you have a large enough sample size, you're testing the vaccine with tens of thousands of people, and it's a chance to see if there are particular underlying conditions or demographics that react badly to the vaccine, where there are safety problems. You want it to be effective, but it also has to be safe. And the current FDA head has said that he's not going to shortcut that process, and certainly under a Biden administration, I would expect an appointee who would not do that either. So, I think we'll be lucky to see an effective vaccine by the middle of next year. Having enough people take the vaccine that it stems the community spread, which is extremely widespread right now, the most widespread of anywhere in the world. The United States once pacing India for the number of new daily cases. It's going to be most of 2021, I think, before we'll be out of the woods on this. I wish I were more optimistic, but realistically, I'm not.
All right.
Yeah, and then there's the issue of how are we going to distribute it once the vaccine is approved, ramping up the manufacture and distributing it to 300 million plus people.
Yeah,
it's not going to be easy.
The State Department of Health also announced this week their distribution plan. So they're looking at that already. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there will be challenges because this is ramping up manufacturing and distribution. This is an unprecedented global scale. And the world has been planning for this for a while, and the United States has not been part of that planning. So an incoming administration, should Biden be able to kick out Trump, and of course that's always the caveat, is going to have a lot of catch up to do and to coordinate with the rest of the world in getting this done.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you spoke earlier about the record numbers of people in Seattle and King County that are getting their votes in, getting their ballots in. Nationally, it appears that people are motivated as well.
Yeah, 47 million people have already voted nationally, and that's with a number of states not having any kind of early voting and obviously not having vote by mail, because only about five states do. That includes a number of important swing states where there's been overwhelming turnout. Georgia has seen overwhelming turnout, for example. And in Texas, Harris County has already seen over a million people vote. That's the county that Houston is in. And that obviously shatters all previous records. And that is despite the state of Texas really trying very hard to make it hard for Harris County to enact some of its measures to, because Harris County has been hit hard by the pandemic, and it's also a heavily Democratic county. And so the Republican state has been trying hard to is sued to stop Obviously, the drop boxes, they were reduced from 12 drop boxes around the county to one. They were unable to do drive-up mailing. A number of different sort of innovative things that Harris County was doing, they can't do, but they have still had over 1 million people vote. And that's important not just for the presidential race, but also because Senator John Conlon is up for re-election. He has a very strong challenger in MJ Hagar, and she is within the margin of error in polling. We also saw polling in, of all places, Kansas, where Biden is within the margin of error, and also there's an open Senate race going on, and that is even closer. So it's looking very much, and those were not on anybody's maps to be contested this year. So we're looking at a very likely, I think, Democratic blowout, and particularly Democratic control of the Senate as well as the White House. Now the next question will be, will it be large enough that any kind of a court challenge that President Trump might mount, will that just be thrown out as ludicrous on the face of it? Because number one, he doesn't have any evidence of the kind of rigged election he will claim, and number two, even if it were rigged, it will hopefully be a wide enough margin that will be preposterous on the face of it. So the margin of the popular vote matters this year in a way that it doesn't most years, because we have a president who's not going to leave willingly. So there has to be a very, very clear mandate, one that the courts will respect as well, even the Supreme Court, even with three Trump nominees on it. And we'll talk about that in a minute.
All right. Well, I know at least one of us watched the final debate, and luckily
he's God. Yeah, I did. And I was live vlogging it, and my intent was to try and fact check it, but I couldn't type fast enough. I mean, the first minute of Trump's first 2 minute response, I counted at least 7 whoppers, and it just kept going like that. Now, fortunately, the moderator, Kirsten Welker, did of NBC News, did a really, really good job. She was really the only winner. I don't think the debate was that meaningful in that it didn't change many minds. Not that there are many minds left to change, but, Trump really needed to try and win back some of the votes he's been hemorrhaging, and he did not do that. He was kept under control, and it did actually kind of resemble a debate this time in that, they were both talking, presumably on issues, but it really wasn't anything new. And Trump spent a lot of his time, pivoting to talking points that sometimes they were related to the question. Sometimes they were not. There were a lot of eye rolling moments. I think a lot of people, were left aghast, even though he's been doing it for a couple of years now, when he compared himself to Abraham Lincoln. That was on a question about race, where he really didn't have anything to say about this summer's unrest.
He keeps repeating that, and it's like nobody really believes that. So why do you keep repeating that?
Yeah, and Biden challenged him on it, mm-hmm. which he should have. It was, he lives in a delusional world, and some of his answers were just, fantasy answers, honestly, especially on COVID. He has not done a great job on COVID, and, acknowledging it might win him some credibility back, but he's incapable of doing that. He's incapable of ever admitting that he did anything wrong. Instead it's always somebody else's fault. In this case, we got the virus from China. Well, yes, but so did the rest of the world. And as the moderator pointed out, they're doing a better job than we are.
Yeah, and where it came from really doesn't matter, because we're in the middle of it, and that's what matters.
Yeah.
Right.
And
what's our response going to be?
And that we had, he likes to talk about, I embargoed travel from China, and that bought us a lot of time. Well, yes, but number one, you didn't embargo all travel from China, and that's how we initially got the virus. And most public health experts would have told you that at that point, it was a futile gesture. And yeah. number two,
and
number
think,
two, with it, yeah. with any kind of time that you did buy, you did nothing with it. Instead, yeah. you downplayed it and pretended it wasn't going to happen. And you're still downplaying it and still pretending that it's not happening. 220,000
yeah.
deaths later.
To that claim that, you know, he embargoed China, therefore he did something about it. Well, it was already here, when he issued the embargo. That's what, geneticists are saying now. Those who have kind of traced the genetic evolution so far of the coronavirus. And number two, the East Coast, I don't think they got it from China. I think they got it from Europe.
Well, they got it from China via Europe. So it's still China's
yeah.
fault.
But
as you say, it doesn't matter.
The China embargo wouldn't work. I mean, if you really want to keep the virus from getting here, he would have closed all borders and no one could get in. And still, it wouldn't have been effective because it was already here at that point.
Exactly. And it was already, you know, spreading in the community.
Widely spreading at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing that you do at that point is you mitigate. You manufacture PPE, so you make sure health providers have enough protective gear. You know, you encourage face mask wearing. You start locking down the economy. And if you do that, and if you do that in a meaningful way, it can, you know, mitigate the spread.
Testing and contact tracing.
Yep. Still, none of that's happening. And, you know, you saw this week, for example, in North Dakota, they shut down their state contact tracing program because it was overwhelmed. They just couldn't keep up. So they just shut it down overall. You know, if they had invested in that, and if the federal government, more importantly, had invested in it rather than leaving it to individual states, many of whom don't have the resources necessarily, you know, that would be in place by now. It would have been in place by summer. It doesn't take that long to get it up and running if you have the intent and the will to do it, which this administration has never had. So, yeah, that's why Donald Trump is not going to get another term, flat out. He's losing people because of coronavirus. And if you look at the polling, the seniors in particular, which he won overwhelmingly, he won older voters, 65 and over, I think by something like 20 or 30 points in 2016. He's losing them by 20 points in the current polling. And the reason is, of course, that you're seeing, you know, their friends are all dying, yeah. or the Trump voters from 2016 are dying. You had a nursing home in Kansas this week where all 62 residents got infected. You know, this is just, been brutal on vulnerable older people. And that's showing up in the election.
Can I ask a question about
sure.
the debate? Now, I think it was the New York Times asked, readers what they thought the most important, topics to be addressed in the debate were. And in addition to COVID-19, and the economy, at the very top of people's list was the environment, and particularly climate change. Was there
yeah.
much in the debate about that?
Yeah, there was a couple questions about climate change. And of course, you know, Trump took the opportunity to attack Joe Biden for wanting to ban fracking, which unfortunately is not his position.
And
he's made that very clear. So it got sidetracked into fracking and clean energy and all the rest of that. Trump did not really get into climate change denial. He was at least smart enough to do that. He pivoted to energy policy instead. Again, you have had with the Trump administration over the past few weeks, and I expect even more so in the next few weeks before the transition. They are doing everything possible to deregulate as much as they can, before they lose office. Some of that will be undone by a new administration and a new Congress. But some of that's going to be permanent damage, and it's going to be very difficult to undo all of it. And you're also losing a lot of professionals in the civil service who enforce those laws. And that's going to take much longer to restore.
All right. Let's move on. This week, the representatives of the anarchist jurisdictions went to court.
Yeah.
Isn't that an oxymoron? Don't they believe in courts? I mean.
Right. Like,
if they were really anarchists, I mean.
Yeah. Now, last month, Donald Trump instructed Attorney General William Barr to declare three cities anarchist jurisdictions and withhold federal funds from them. Those three cities are Seattle, Portland, and New York City. Of course, Trump has been running on a law and order campaign, heavily exaggerating the violence surrounding protests related to police brutality in cities led by Democrats. He's tried to depict these cities as lawless places with high crime rates and, quote, cities that are burning, you know, both of which are outright lies. And I've even had relatives contact me personally to make sure I'm okay because Seattle is burning. and that's total BS. I mean, Seattle is not burning. Portland is not burning. New York City is not burning. In fact, Seattle is doing pretty well given the circumstances, just like other cities around the nation were struggling with the COVID-19 economic downturn.
Oh, there was a moment in the debate, by the way, where mm-hmm. Trump claimed that everybody's leaving New York. It's a ghost town now.
No, it's just everybody's indoors trying not to spread COVID-19.
Yeah, there's still 8 million people there and another yes. few million people who commute into work every day. It's got a lot of people in it.
Yeah,
it just doesn't have Donald Trump in it anymore, which is, you know, addition by subtraction.
Yeah, and you know, cities around the nation would be doing just fine, except that small businesses are really starting to suffer and starting to shut down because there is not been an extension of the economic stimulus package that Congress passed earlier this year. Now, Trump says that's Nancy Pelosi's fault. Nancy Pelosi, however, is the person with a plan, and she's been trying to get the Republicans to at least negotiate with her. And the only one who will talk yeah. to her is Stephen Mnuchin. No one
and the
else.
House's plan to pass two different plans, in fact.
Yeah, and the House has already tried.
So she's done her job.
Yeah, the Republicans in the Senate can't agree with Donald Trump on whether or not an economic stimulus package is needed, which of course it absolutely is needed, and B, what that plan should look like. So, that's the state of these cities. And so, of course, they went this week to court here in Seattle to sue the Trump administration. Now, the reason they went to court, because, you know, Trump could be defeated in the election and this could, you know, his order to withhold federal funds could never actually, you know, it might be if Biden wins that never, is enforced. But, the federal government is already moving to exclude these cities from consideration for transportation grants, which is particularly terrible for the Seattle area. We're trying to get transportation grants to replace or repair some major bridges and to continue the expansion of our Sound Transit light rail system. And the city of New York, who have major repairs to make to their subway system. Overall,
yeah, Seattle the largest subway system in the country by
yeah,
far.
Yeah, overall, Seattle could lose $230 million in federal funds. Portland, it's a bigger amount, $340 million. And for New York City, it's a total of $12 billion that they need from the federal government to replace infrastructure and do various other things that's New York City residents need. So, of course, it was absolutely vital that they go to court to at least halt this unconstitutional declaration by Donald Trump.
Yeah, they've got a pretty rock solid case, I think.
Oh, yeah. You know, because Trump has tried this before and it was ruled unconstitutional in the courts. The executive can't overrule the fact that Congress has already appropriated funds to these local jurisdictions. He can't suddenly just say, oh, no, stop spending the money.
All right.
Yep.
Also this week, a new report out about 545 children still separated from their parents.
Yeah. 545 immigrant children are still separated from their parents. These are kids that were taken from their parents under the Trump administration's zero tolerance immigration policy enforced at the southern border with Mexico.
And it was just the first year of the policy. So this is the tip of the iceberg.
60 of those children were under the age of 5 when they were ripped from their families and institutionalized by ICE and the Department of Health and Human Services. And so much time has passed now that it's especially difficult to find these parents, more than 2/3 of whom it is estimated may have been deported back to their home countries.
The original and to give you an idea, the groups that were in charge of the search for these parents were literally going door to door in some cases in Central America trying to find them.
In Honduras and Nicaragua and Guatemala and places like that.
And unable to,
Yeah, now the original reason that most of these folks fled their home countries was to avoid violence. So the fact that they were deported back to those countries means that either they might not be alive anymore, or they may have fled their home country again to avoid the violence, so it's particularly hard to find them in their home cities or their home regions. And of course, some parents have surrendered their claims on their children, often because they don't want to bring their children home to experience the violence that is going on that caused them to flee their home countries in the first place. And with COVID-19 making travel very, very difficult, advocates for these children and these families are having a doubly difficult time tracking down the parents. So that means that essentially the U.S. government has kidnapped, they ended up kidnapping over 5,500 children and has kept over 500 of them.
And deported their parents to what may have been a death sentence.
Yeah, and even more disturbing is that of the 5,000 kids that the U.S. government has released ostensibly back to their parents, at least 362 of those children were released to custodians who can't now be located. And no one, not Health and Human Services, not immigration advocates, and not the children's parents, know where those kids are. So that means the Trump administration may have engaged in human trafficking of young children, unwittingly so. And this really
I would not qualify it with may have. They did.
Yeah. Here. So this really puts Donald Trump's support for QAnon into some real perspective.
Right.
Okay. So, and then I want to say too, last Sunday, the New York Times reported that a draft report by the Inspector General of the Justice Department shows that former Attorney General Jeff Sessions specifically told U.S. attorneys for those 5 border states along the Mexico border to pursue the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy, even when it meant taking infants from their mothers. Jeff Sessions has denied that he did this, saying to the press that he had never really intended to separate children from their parents. But his numerous people interviewed by the Inspector General said otherwise, including Mr. Sessions' own Assistant Attorney General, Rodney J. Rosenstein, who said that Sessions fully understood the consequences, what the consequences were. And in a conference call with the 5 U.S. attorneys, Sessions said, quote, "We need to take the children away," end quote. So that's pretty damning, right?
And I would expect that unless they get a massive amount of shredding done between now and January, we're going to find a whole lot of evidence when a new administration takes place of these kind of crimes against humanity.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I mean, they probably didn't document a whole lot of this, which is why the Inspector General had to interview people and get them on the record saying this. That was one of the problems with the whole zero tolerance policy in the first place, is that ICE didn't document who was the parent of what child. So that is what's leading to a lot of the difficulty in reuniting families under this policy, you know.
They didn't care.
Now that we're trying to fix that problem. They just didn't care. Yeah. And, you know, the narrative that the Trump administration puts out is that former Homeland Secretary Christian Nielsen was responsible for the family separations. And, in fact, she objected to it right off the bat and only agreed to it after she experienced a lot of pressure from Donald Trump, who was the main advocate for it and who ordered it in the first place, and from Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein. She eventually agreed to it, but the responsibility for it goes right to the top.
Yeah, as is true with many, many of the crimes of the Trump administration.
Yes.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are pretty much out of time. Still have the daily marches here in Seattle.
Oh, yeah, we do. They are still going on, and you can find out where they're meeting each night. The morning and evening, the Morning March Seattle is a Facebook page that you can check for that. And Seattle Evening March is on Instagram, and they post there where they're meeting each evening about 7 o'clock. So, yeah, get out there and make yourself heard. And we've got an election coming up, and I'm sure that's going to be on a lot of people's minds as well. And, you know, we may be in the streets to try and save our democracy soon. So get ready for that, and hope that it won't be necessary, but it may well be. So get your winter gear and your marching boots ready.
Yeah.
All right.